Hello, good morning, and welcome. It's Friday, the 15th of May, 2020, and we're back with episode 152. Before getting started, though, and just bear with me, I'll explain in a moment. Wait for it. Piotr, wake up. Good morning. Stop sleeping. Yeah, all right, so allow me to explain. So you may have noticed over on our website at Hogan Co. that we've got a new associate on the team. His name is Piotr Spolniki. He's a PhD candidate for city and urban community and regional planning in Gdansk, Poland. And, well, it's been brought to my attention that he may have set my podcast to be his alarm clock. Yeah, so quite literally my voice is the first thing that he hears in the mornings. Yeah, that sounds remarkably awkward. Please don't ever repeat this. Anyway, now that I've thoroughly embarrassed the both of us, let's carry on. Because today we've got a fantastic guest, Andy Schott. He's the Program Director for Automated Vehicle Systems at the Virginia Tech Transportation Institute, VTTI, in Blacksburg, Virginia. And we had a fantastic conversation about all the work they're doing out there. They've built a fantastic 2-mile test track facility, which allows them to pretty much produce any weather and lighting conditions you can think of. Although now that I say that, Andy, I don't know whether you guys can produce snow, although I would imagine you could based on all the other things you said you can do. In any event, yeah, it's a really great conversation. We really kind of zoomed out as well to discuss the whole AV and mobility space generally. I would like to say a thing, though. Something has once again gone wrong with my portion of the recording. The audio for me sounds really quite poor, I'm afraid. It sounds like the audio is clipping from too high of a gain, but I don't know why that would have occurred. In any event, don't worry, Andy sounds fantastic. That is, of course, the more important half of the conversation, or in this case, even more than half, as it were. So anyway, I hope you're sitting comfortably. But before getting started, just a friendly reminder, please don't forget to drop me 5 stars over on Apple Podcasts, if you would, please. That's one of the best things that you can do to help grow this podcast with me, and of course, continuing to share it with all your friends and colleagues. Anyway, hope you're sitting comfortably. We've got nearly an hour with Andy Schott, the Program Director for Automated Vehicle Systems at VTTI. Let's dive in and get started.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
So here we go. It's okay. Just started. But yeah, man, it's been a disaster here. So believe it or not, our cable is still totally shot to hell during the day.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And this is after it's many, many calls. And I think 2 or 3, I forget what they call them, supervisors or tech, whatever, highest up the chain have come out here. I've had 2 2-hour phone calls with these, again, whatever they're called, supervisors, and they validated that indeed the issue is something about the uplink is being bottlenecked, and I would have guessed downlink, but whatever. And yeah, that it could actually be another couple of months until it's resolved, because they have to physically construct stuff, which is, you know, requires permitting, not to mention the actual construction work itself. So we are doing this once again tethered through my iPhone, which I'll tell you transparently, 95% of the work time, it's worked great. So I don't anticipate any issues. But of course, fingers still crossed.
You know, it's not really important that you have internet out in San Francisco or anything, right? Like,
no, not even slightly. Not. No, man, wow. It's, yeah. You know, my team are based in Europe for the most part. There's a few here in the States, the rest are in Europe, and it's pretty incessant, the ridicule I've been getting.
Oh, man. What can you do, right, other than move during this time?
I'll tell you what I did do, actually, is I put a pretty big complaint to the neighborhood and next door saying, look, guys, this is the issue. You don't all need to see your faces all of the time on your daily Zoom calls or whatever. And we've actually officially got rid of video entirely in our team chats as well. That didn't go over so well.
It didn't really.
No, there was a lot of, yeah, I was very surprised too. Folks, I guess, really like staring up each other's nose holes.
You know, I think there's a bit of a quarantine project with growing beards right now out here.
That's true.
So, you know, it's getting continuously probably worse. And so more people willing to turn off the video, I think.
Well, that's a good point. And I guess I hope that continues. We shall see. How are you guys otherwise? Everybody's good on campus and elsewhere?
Yep. This is really the last day of exams today. And and so tomorrow is virtual commencement, I believe. It's Saturday, but I think it's tomorrow. And so, you know, we're all just feverishly kind of finishing up things, grading massive amounts of papers, and just trying to move forward. Everybody seems pretty happy and healthy down in this southwest corner down here in Virginia. So I would say all things good.
Yeah, I've heard the same. I think I told you, a dear friend of mine from third grade, believe it or not, he's out in just outside of Charlottesville in what's it called? Earliesville, I believe is the name.
Okay.
That rings a bell. Well, cool. Well, look, why don't we more or less get started here? For better or worse, I'd love to just kind of get a recap, kind of your background, obviously, which I guess we sort of started last time, but this is actually really more for my sake personally, because you'll excuse me for this was kind of a while ago, a month and a half ago, I think we tried to do this. So let's kind of take it from the top, and it goes without saying, I'm pretty thrilled to have you back. So thanks so much for your patience, and we'd love to dive into this finally and learn all about what you're up to.
Yeah. You know, I'll just say I'm excited to talk to you today, and the, you know, with COVID and all the activity going on right now in the space, it's probably a little bit better time for us to do this, because I feel like there's definitely more to talk about right now.
Well, that's one point of view. The alternative is, what else is everybody else going to do but sit and listen to us chatting all day?
Rating sky high, Mark.
Exactly.
Get the part over where I talk about myself, and so we can move on to much more exciting and fun things. I would say that my background is, I'm a human factors guy, researching and designing technology around the user. And I've been doing that for almost 20 years, most notably, I'd say, in transportation, but also in healthcare. I interned at a couple places back when I finished my master's degree from University of Idaho, with Battelle out in Seattle, and then with Daimler Chrysler and their Freightliner headquarters in Portland. And then I actually had been really trying to get out to Virginia Tech, because Virginia Tech Transportation Institute, in the year 2000, they put together this kind of state-of-the-art facility called the Smart Road. And I was doing some research on fog, and usually you do that kind of thing in a driving simulator. VTTI out here built the Smart Road where they could actually create weather, rain, fog, snow over a 2-mile track. And really? That was like a playground to a researcher, right? Especially in the field. And so it took about a year to really work on trying to get an offer to come to a university to kind of do some advanced research. And I got here in 2004 and just started diving in, truck research, light vehicle research, obviously advanced systems, fatigue monitoring systems. And then VTTI over the years has just really grown. It went from, it's over 30 years old now, went from, just a few faculty and staff doing some research at the university to now we're over 500 people, 10 buildings, $120 million infrastructure, multiple test tracks, and just continuing to really be, contract research focused both for federal, state, and OEMs, tech suppliers. I was here for many years, almost 10 years, and then I took a stint in healthcare up in Washington, D.C. for a couple of years. Moved out to Las Vegas and worked with some startup companies, spun up a few startups out there. And then when, the automated vehicle activity, some might say hype, right? But the attention towards it in 2015 and 2016, it brought me back here to VTTI to really help kind of start to help strategize on how to support the increased activity and make sure that VTTI could serve all of our research sponsors and and provide some significant value with the accelerated activity in the space. So basically the last 4 years I've been back here and helping the Center for Automated Vehicle Systems do everything AV.
So I guess, yeah, why don't we dive into that specifically? I mean, you said 2 miles of road, which can have dynamic weather kind of on demand.
Yeah. So the smart road, at the time we built it, it's got a half mile section. So this is a,
Yeah, can I Google this to see it real quick? I'm super curious to see what we're talking about.
Absolutely. You can see YouTube videos and you can, okay. And I can obviously share some links with you. So, you know, 20 years ago when it was built, it was basically a 2.2 mile long federal DOT specced out highway. And the idea was that it would eventually keep going and it would kind of be an a bridge between Roanoke and Blacksburg. But they built it early and then let us use it as a research facility. And so on a half mile of it, we built weather towers, kind of basically imagine remodeled snow towers from a ski mountain. And then we started to fabricate different nozzles on them so that we could create different types of volumes and rain droplet size, create fog, obviously snow, could make ice. And then
Hollywood would love this.
Right. Absolutely. and then we also, there's about a mile section that overlaps with that where we built one of a kind variable lighting section. So we've got towers that you can change the heights and the spaces in between, and they all have 3 different luminaire modules on them. So we can recreate 95% of the overhead roadway lighting. So really what we were able to do with that facility was build a connected smart weather making high speed testing facility. And then since then we've of course expanded, connected it to some public roadways. We built the surface kind of urban suburban layout. So we can do some of that urban testing. And then right now we're finishing up paving a rural road test track on a couple hundred acres we have out here in Virginia. And the idea there is we're trying to prepare for what we ultimately believe is AVs have to figure out how to work in some pretty rough rural roads, because it's the majority of our roadways out here in the US. And we want to get ahead of that by having both like urban highway and a rural track all seamlessly connected together.
So I'm really glad you touched on that, because I just realized rather embarrassingly that's sort of a aspect that's never really been discussed much on this podcast, apart from maybe a footnote. Can we dive into that just for a little bit, if only for a few minutes, because that is a big issue. You're right. And, you know, one of the questions, of course, is, you know, frankly, what is it going to look like? How is it? Well, technologically, how is it going to work? How is it going to be embraced? How does it get deployed? Do you have any preliminary thoughts on that so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interested me about this space is more about how the reason a lot of activity on AVs is really focused on urban areas is because they can create a business model around this with a really high dense population and help to actually put these very expensive service vehicles out on the road and actually have a business model that can support it, right? This rural scenario where you have very long stretches outside of the cities, a vehicle spending a lot of time taking somebody one way, but not necessarily able to take somebody back in. It's just one of those things where it's kind of last on the list. The focus is, can we do something, build this tech? And it's not just can we, it's should we? And what kind of revenue generating model can we have behind it? So this rural approach to this is that, you know, as we continue into this larger advanced mobility space, where cities are crowded and now with COVID too, people are working more from home and the spread is going to happen and real estate's going to continue to build out. I feel like there isn't just a clear division between rural and urban. It's going to just start to spread over larger geographic distances. And these vehicles are going to need to do more than just sit in their tiny little operational design domain. So hopefully the idea is that eventually the business models for the urban and some of these larger like airport highway services start to cover things and personally owned higher automation vehicles are out there. Then they can start to figure out how to deploy and bridge the gap with the rural side. And maybe it's going to be focused on not as ubiquitous in those scenarios, maybe for utility, maybe for getting healthcare access to patients, or vice versa, patients access to more healthcare areas, and some of those utilities first. Or the big one would be shipment and of goods, right? Delivery of goods rather than just people.
Well, I guess it would certainly avoid a lot of the last mile problems, because presumably you'd have less of that. It would be more like the last foot or two problem, I would guess, just due to, well, a lot less things that can go wrong in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yeah. That last, you say that, and that's, it reminds me of, you know, all of the, and you see at CES, all the robots that are essentially trying to deliver a package to the front door after the AV gets there. And just how comedic and creepy these robots are as they kind of head up onto the porch and drop something off. You can imagine, you know, the grandma and grandpa fearful for their life as they watch this robotic alien bring up their big box of Campbell soup or something.
Did you see the robot dog thing in Singapore walking around trying to mandate social distancing?
Oh, I heard about it, but I did not see that. Yeah. That's, there's some video on it. Is that what you're saying?
There is. Yeah. You should pull it up at some point. It's I mean, it's funny too, because we were joking about such a thing just before we did our webinar last week on, and actually it's funny you mentioned it, exactly, real estate, which we should dive into for a moment. But yeah, it was sort of a joke that I think we threw out there. We certainly talked about it internally, right? Gosh, maybe there's going to be some sort of social distancing droids, keeping distance, you know, in construction zones and that sort of thing. Definitely not the droids you're looking for. but who knows? But look, you made a really interesting comment about real estate too. Yeah, you said sort of everything blurring together, as it were, everyone staying at home. I somewhat tongue-in-cheek may have coined the term unmobility, that indeed the new mobility might be precisely none of it at all. And you know, there was this argument that sort of turned up that suggested, you know, especially with COVID, but also obviously with autonomous vehicles, that effectively suburbs will, you know, quite likely increase in value, because the stigma against, well, the stigma about living in the suburbs will effectively go away, either because, well, you don't need to commute in the first place, or alternatively, even if you did need to commute still at least some of the time, if not even all of the time, well, with an AV, at least the end game, level 4, level 5, you could effectively just go to sleep at the wheel or do work in the car. So I think that's a very real argument that suburbs could suddenly see a big boom. Which then raises profound social and practical questions with respect to affordable housing generally.
Well, that's right. Affordable housing, it's win-win for the real estate. Now, I mean, I'm guessing here, let's be honest, I'm not a real estate professional or a real estate investor, but you got to imagine in these dense cities, you know, there's only so much, so many assets that you can leverage consistently. And so it's always a grab for new land, long-term investment in it. And the faster the sprawl happens, the higher the value that's going to be for you. So I can see that there's really incentives for everyone involved. But I imagine it's going to accelerate a lot faster because people have had a taste that they can get work done. Well, not everybody, but a lot of people can in this kind of shelter in place scenario. So maybe a lot more flex work is going to happen. And I think that's, if anything, it's going to accelerate the potential for getting mobility services, whether it's automation or just ride shares or different models, to start spreading out and going further.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Yeah, that's the perfect segue, actually, for what I wanted to ask you about, actually. So let's talk about that with respect to COVID specifically, all the reduced traffic. You've probably heard of so many cities just deciding to shut down miles and miles of roads, just because why not give more land to pedestrians and bicyclists? Here in the Bay Area, Oakland shut down 75 miles of road. Lima shut down, I want to say a few hundred kilometers. Milan, you know, they've done the same there. Isn't now sort of the optimal time to start really ramping up testing? Because one of the questions that keeps getting thrown our way a lot is, you know, AV companies are either doomed or they don't know what to do, or they've got to pivot to something else altogether, which we are starting to see in the form of really ramping up delivery here in California. Nuro just launched its affectionately named R2 to do, you know, small scale delivery and so forth. And I've started suggesting, for instance, isn't now the best time even to start testing true driverless, you know, ride sharing effectively on these closed off roads? I mean, talk about minimal risk finally. What do you think? Should this be a catalyst that we just, you know, grasp onto, or is it indeed kind of a temporary pause on things?
So, yeah, I mean, I see your point on that element. It's like some of the memes I've seen out there where they've got like Chris Farley yelling, like, do all the road construction now.
Well, yeah, that too. Exactly.
But so one of the key things that we're dealing with right now is, you know, I have our team has at least 20 projects ongoing at any time, just in our automated vehicle center. But a lot of what we do, as well as what these companies are doing, like let's say, for example, Argo AI, is that their testing is very much putting their systems out there in typical traffic flow conditions, high traffic, things that are cyclical. And because it's atypical right now, the value that you're receiving isn't exactly helpful in trying to train certain models. Getting out there in the road when there's not a lot of traffic helps you in a very... It might help your performance metrics with showing how many times you didn't have to have a takeover or transition.
I mean, that's a very good point.
But, you know, people like teams like Cruise, who are working in San Francisco in the heart of the chaos, that's where they're going to accelerate their learning and their training the fastest. Torque Robotics, for example, before Daimler Trucks acquired them, they had years where their Asimov vehicles were just driving around Las Vegas because it's just so unpredictable. The elements of vulnerable road users or pedestrians and what they might do, they really got to put their systems to the test and train them by being in some really, you know, what we'll call hairy situations. So right now, many of our projects were paused for two reasons. One is a lot of where we would be testing these systems just isn't the same right now, so we're not getting as much value. And then the other element is just protection of our employees. This element of just, you know, let them be safe with their families. And for us, we are, you know, Virginia Tech is a state university. And so when the governor says, you know, government employees shelter in place, if we started getting out there and testing, we'd probably get in a little bit of trouble there. But yeah, I see what you're saying with regards to the opportunities is that I think there's probably some of them that they could be trying out. Like you said, delivery systems, trying out some of their service models to see if they can do things like routing and optimization, some of those business day-to-day operational things. Now, the other, I think what's happening right now is most of these teams, these AI teams, as well as our team, we have so much data that during a time like this, we're definitely slowing down from going out collecting new data, but we're rolling around in the data we already have. And so it's not like progress is halted because the wheels in the bus go round and round. They've stopped right now out there on the roads, but everybody's rolling around in the data right now and still making progress.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And with respect to employee safeties, I promise not to let this erupt into a huge debate, but I'm just curious, do you have any thoughts on Elon's decision with respect to the factory reopening against regulations, which have, by the way, since been approved as of, I think, this morning or yesterday. But until then, anyway, there was a big, well... People are sort of wondering what, you know, what's the guy doing?
So, you know, it's the Elon, he can't wake up in the morning without some kind of controversy. Like, why would he even pick those socks to put on? Right. Like, I don't know. I don't know the details, so I can't speak to it too much because I don't know which factories, the number of people that we're really, what we're really talking about, but there are plants even in Virginia and whatnot that still have people working in them. you know, you don't hear about them and they don't become publicized as much, but there's a lot of factories and manufacturing plants and that are still trimmed down, but still operational and running. So when you hear, you know, Elon opening it back up, you know, it gets a lot of media attention for sure. But I wouldn't say it's completely atypical.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, there's an argument to be made, I think, that companies are always responsible for their employees, and we should hold them accountable in this situation too.
Absolutely.
I haven't bounced this off any other attorneys yet, so I could be wrong about this, but in law we have a concept called inherently dangerous activity. It's an activity which is so dangerous that even if you're taking all the precautions, say, for example, you're driving nuclear waste, for instance, or transporting known vicious, dangerous animals, even if you're super careful and if something goes wrong, you are still strictly liable. So you can't just say that you were being safe. There is no degree of adequate safety. So I wonder whether there's an argument to be made that, you know, if you choose to reopen your business during COVID, that could effectively be classified as an inherently dangerous activity, and you are therefore strictly liable if anybody starts getting sick.
Yeah, I mean, the crazy thing about this entire time right now with this health crisis is that there's so much disparate knowledge around this and contradictory information, and businesses can't intelligently make a decision on if it's safe or not, and so they shouldn't, right? Like this is that time where even the best healthcare professionals and epidemiologists out there, they're not exactly sure on every element. And it sounds like it's a little bit different in certain cultures anyway, just the way it's rolling out. So yeah, that's a tough decision to make as a business when you're, you know, 99% of them are definitely not experts in health crises, you know? So yeah, it's a tough one to make. And if other people are going to work, you're going to feel obligated. It puts a lot of pressure and anxiety on people who actually might fear going back. But if it's expected, it's a tough one to deal with. But yeah, you're the lawyer, right? Like, you know, you know better than all of us that you know, lawsuits can happen for any reason. It's just whether you'll win or not is all.
True.
I can't imagine that. You know, some of them might just, they have no choice because they're going to go under if they don't. But I imagine it's not all of them that are making those decisions. Mm-hmm, it's not the case for all of them.
So, you know, I'd love to chat more than some of the other kind of exciting projects or I guess tests, experiments, you know, you've been working on. And before I forget, since you mentioned what you've done with you said the sort of 2 miles of smart city that you guys have set up there. I learned about a thing a few months ago, which sort of surprised me. I wasn't familiar with it before then. So-called GPR, so ground penetrating radar. Are you familiar with this very much? And if so, do you have any thoughts on it? Insofar as its viability to obviously, I guess, augmenting, say LIDAR, camera vision, computer vision, and so on to make an AV just better in more situations?
This has come up, but I haven't had time to look into it or talk to some of our engineers and our sensor crew. You know, we've been playing with different levels of radar for years, obviously, and LIDAR and the whole suite. I'm not too sure. I think some of the people who I like to ask questions about feasibility of these things are NASA Langley Research Center. They've got some really, really smart people over there doing some pretty impressive space sensor research. They've got radars there that obviously cost more than the building I'm in probably. And so they can afford that when they put those kind of things in space, right? They don't have to get it small and make it cost efficient enough to put on a vehicle. But ground penetrating radar, I haven't really heard that come up recently with regards to potential value, although it does sound, in this space, every sensor adding and supplementing, is going to be something that people are interested in. So where have you heard?
That makes sense. Well, yeah, and to your point, I haven't heard that much apart from this one team over at MIT, I guess. I think they had initially developed it privately, then I think they got some sort of military funding because of course, and then it's really the only such example I've read about, but I guess the idea is that you can effectively, and this is my word, not theirs, I think, my understanding is that you effectively can fingerprint the road or parking lot structure or whatever, effectively able to pick out such small details that you then construct effectively a subsurface map with super high precision, which is then effectively, downloaded to the car. So any car then has its own onboard ground penetrating radar, so it can compare what it's seeing in real time to what the pre-scanned road looks like. The idea being that it can then always pinpoint exactly where it is based on, sort of a fingerprint comparison, as it were. But I haven't really heard much else besides that, nor have I heard of anybody else pursuing such an approach. It just sounded kind of intriguing to me, and especially the bit where it would also work even with respect to, say, the rebar in concrete structures, in parking lots, for instance.
That's really fascinating. The
right?
You know, now that we got HPC, we have high-performance computing. It's amazing what people are able to jump into now, because I can't imagine the ground penetrating radar would have much of a distance to it, right?
No, like it's not. You're right. It's only, as I recall, it's only it's only a few inches. I want to say, or am I mistaken? I want to say 6 inches or so, give or take. No, not even that. No, it's like a few centimeters. So 2 to 4 inches, I think. I can pull it up, but it wasn't very far. You're right.
There's a similar system or technology, I think, that we worked with Southwest Research Institute on, and the system, it's failing me, but they're essentially, what they were doing, were using cameras that were doing similar. They're pointed straight down at the road, and it wasn't looking at the lane line like you would, like some of the original deployments were for lane tracking and for autonomous vehicles, you know, keeping them in the lane using cameras pointed straight down. This was doing it where it was looking at the road fingerprint, so to speak, and trying to use machine vision to help process and help supplement the map that it was also, or the trace that it previously ran on, to help make sure that it could smooth the trajectory. But ground penetrating radar, that the skeletal, the infrastructure underneath it, that's kind of fascinating. We have a team here who, they're working on infrastructure, surfaces, pavements, concretes. They've got 14 different concretes and pavements on the smart road. And then they have a asphalt facility next to our urban area where they dig down 20 feet. They do innovative new layering techniques and pave, and then they put this weighted trailer system on top that runs back and forth and basically recreates, 10 to 20 years worth of roadway wear and tear in just a couple months. And then that trailer moves, and then they do core sampling and they look down in there. And it surprises people when you look at some of what's underneath the first layer of some of these roads, especially over bridges and in areas of, I could imagine how there might be something there. Depends on, I'd be fascinated to see at what speeds this is beneficial, though.
So just reading their blurb here in the MIT News, I guess it works up to 60 miles per hour.
Wow.
Yeah, it's I don't know, it's just interesting. But again, like I said, I've not really seen or read this anywhere else, so who knows how viable it really is. But it's just an interesting approach. But then it also kind of always, and I always come back to this question, right? Which is, I get the I guess I'll call it the technological or the research pride of figuring out these kind of, absolute limits at which AVs can drive. But I keep coming back to the same question that I always ask, which is, and I don't mean this in a dismissive way, but like, why bother? Like, I still think that there's just much more of a benefit from a business case to just focus on level four vehicles, treat them as I always say, virtual trains. They can only drive on certain roads. And sure, they can only drive in certain conditions. I mean, even humans can't drive in all conditions, and just call it a day. I mean, I would say that the first company you can deploy, at least, geo-limited, even conditions-limited level four vehicles, they will win if they get these deployed widespread. I mean, there's plenty of places where this could be done already.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I tend to agree with you on this for sure. I think the their focus should be on the business model that can help them establish themselves in this area and then build on it as they move forward. Some of the really advanced outside external high speed scenarios where you really need that, you know, highway driving is not overly complex to right. put some automation into. You still have the edges and corner cases, of course, but yeah, I think focusing on the low speed area that provides the most value to the most amount of people, and also, you know, with density of traffic and people comes risk. As good as people are, we're still not good at staying vigilant. we still fault in these cases. So yeah, you know, focus on providing value to these high density areas and then worry about the other ones as you really innovate and improve your tech.
And to the point about business case, I mean, so do you have any thoughts on what's going to happen with Zooks? I mean, I heard they're valued at like, what, $2.7 billion. And one of the things that I guess we've been seeing so much is it's like a high school dance. Everybody's partnered off with somebody now, right? So Ford's with Argo, GM's with Cruise, Voyage now with Fiat Chrysler, Hyundai with Aptiv. I'm losing track of who's with whom. But the point is, what's going to happen to them? I mean, I think I put it out there already that, so I'm just going with Volkswagen. I wouldn't be super surprised if Volkswagen grabs them up.
It's funny you bring this up and maybe you've talked about this before and I've missed them on your podcast, but I call it people start hugging each other when they start in that traffic disillusionment, they start to go down that slope.
Yeah.
But it's what economies do, right? Like what you see is partnering, bundling of services to essentially hedge risk. And at the same time, what's cool about this is that when they acquire a company, in theory, they're also just investing in that brand.
Right, exactly. Absolutely.
And, you know, the old traditional way of what these OEMs would do is they'd use tier one suppliers to build a lot of their systems, but they would label it as their own, right? Like that was the relationship.
Yep.
Now these OEMs can't wait to talk about the acquisition of this new tech computer AI company because it gives them credibility into this new area. They're not claiming that they know how to do it, but they're bringing them in and then they work together. You got the safety, long-term reliability OEMs, and then you've got the innovative, highly dynamic tech companies and computers, and together they can probably do this the way transportation needs it to be done. And also the way our regulatory infrastructure kind of requires it is that you got to test these things like crazy and show some super reliability it takes, you know, 20 to 40 years for an automated system or any system really, a safety system to have been proven or ideated, built, tested, and then deployed and get out into 90% of the vehicles on the roadway. Like it's a long game for sure. Just because cars are so long. So you've definitely, I think it will benefit any AI company to team up with a car company because there can be other acquisitions or partnerships later as well. But it also benefits the car companies to have a dedicated AI team that can tailor it towards their vehicles and can give the attention towards what unique competitive business model they're going to try to keep in the shadows as long as they can before they offer it. So,
yeah, and most AI teams aren't exactly well versed in the intricacies of building cars, and I think that was one of the weird things about Zooks, that they were trying to build both the software and hardware stack, if I'm not mistaken, as well as the vehicle from the ground up. And apart from Cruise recently building and announcing their Origin, I can't off the top of my head think of any other company, which is first and foremost an AV tech company, trying to build a car, an entire vehicle from the ground up. That's highly unusual, right?
Yeah, I mean, Google and then Waymo, there was, you know, there's always...
Well, there was their first car, yeah, sure. Yeah. But even they effectively gave up on that, right? And so that's why they're using the Chrysler Pacifica now, right? Which might actually be the only cool minivan in history.
I mean, I worked for Daimler Chrysler when the Pacifica came out, and it was,
there you go.
So many of the company cars all of a sudden went from the Mercedes out front to the Chrysler Pacifica. I guess the only other one that we heard rumor of back in the day was Apple playing around, and they're like, "Oh, Apple's building a car." You know, it's vaporware or ever confirmed. But you're right. I think it is strange. And you must have been looking into Zoox more than I have recently, but, you know, kit versus car, were they doing this in some kind of order, or was it really all at the same time since inception? Like,
I know they were using a lot of mule cars. I think some sort of a Toyota SUV. I'm not sure, but to answer your question, I think they were effectively doing it concurrently. Like, they had one team testing their kit on some sort of mule, and then they were concurrently building this other vehicle from the ground up as well. I don't know. I will say that I wasn't able to get that much information on what they were doing, and I feel a bit remiss in saying so. But I don't know.
I can't imagine some of these tech companies at early stages, lots of investment money, talented people playing in the space. I don't think it hurts them to move from computers to understanding physics and mechanics as well, because that's a huge gap that often gets missed. Putting in values and understanding kinematics, but not the physics of really what's going on, you can really miss some heavy gaps. So I'm sure it's benefited them through the time, but I wouldn't call it the audacity, but the confidence, the sheer confidence of thinking, we're going to build vehicles too, and we're going to do this, is pretty impressive, right? Like, it's a very difficult thing to do, especially in the U.S. because of the crash protection requirements that go into these things. Like, maybe the element was it's going to be low speed, and they want to figure out how to control their entire production so they don't rely on somebody else. But you would think that the vehicle platforms eventually would become more of a commodity in this space. And as they move away from people thinking of it as a brand, like, oh, I'm riding in the Ford taxi, to more of like, I'm riding in the espresso coffee taxi this morning for the conference room taxi service. And, you know, whose car it is less of a concern, more about the service that I'm actually trying to lease at the time.
That is brilliantly stated. That's a really good way of putting it. Because I've often asked the question in a rather more ambiguous sort of way, convoluted sort of way, which is, you know, how does it, you know, it comes down to a marketing thing too, right? Like, how does a company like, say, BMW, who've always called themselves the ultimate driving machine? I mean, if you've got an autonomous car, I mean, that doesn't really have much meaning to it anymore. So you're right. It's just going to come down to the actual experience being in the car. And as you say, the platform, that's a really good call. Let's see. Well, thanks for your time, because I just realized how long it has been that we've been going. Just, I guess, maybe one or two quick points, if I may.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Just curious, with all the testing that you guys do, that you see, and all the, obviously, the really proactive work that you're doing with the testing facilities at your smart city that you've developed, do you have any thoughts? Have you heard much of, and if not, I'll just skip ahead to the next part of the question. Toyota have developed, they announced at CES this past year, Woven City at the base of Mount Fuji. Are you familiar with this?
I am not. I can't believe that I missed that. Then I work with some great Toyota engineers on our ISO committees in this space, and how that has not come up, I don't know. But now
Do you feel like just pulling it up in your browser real quick? If not, it's not a big deal. The reason I wanted to ask you about this, and I can. While you pull it up, maybe I'll just start leading with my question.
Okay, go ahead.
So, just Google like Toyota Woven City, and it should pop up pretty quick. They've got a beautiful splash image at the base of Mount Fuji. It looks spectacular, and they've done a nice job kind of dropping all these various sort of iconography for all the various techs they're developing, from AVs to EVs to hydrogen, because nobody knows why, and I just don't. It's ridiculous. putting aside the hydrogen thing, which happy to debate till I'm blue in the face if you like. It's a thing that we've talked about a lot internally amongst, our team here at our firm. And indeed, we touched on it on our webinar last week as well. I just, the thing that we can't wrap our head around is kind of why, like, where is this going? The idea being, you kind of alluded to it, and that's why I thought about this. Your response to my question earlier, you know, is now not the best time to start testing at a faster rate AVs. And you made the good point that in the absence of traffic and all the other usual hazards, the data you're going to be getting off this isn't necessarily going to be particularly useful. I'd like to argue that it's at least non-zero, but I suppose in some cases it might actually be sub-zero, below zero, because you might just be getting meaninglessly bad data, I suppose. This is a convoluted way of getting to my question about Woven City. Just, you know, it's such a fabricated thing. It's so far away from, well, any central urban area that it may not be a practically useful place to do such sort of testing. It's just too kind of artificial. It doesn't make sense. So is there not a risk of, well, just bad data?
Yeah, I think it's, I'd have to look into this more, but I think the ideas of what we've talked about before with automated vehicles, if we had control over what vehicles were on the road to begin with, we mm-hmm. could automate them like a school of fish, right? But because it's a mixed mode and you don't control the entire city and everybody on it, it becomes very hard. So the other piece that I'll mention is like smart cities and the continued disappointment of people trying to deploy these I'm doing air quotes here, smart cities, is that they consistently use little components that are advanced or innovative, like electric public transportation, and then we're going to try bikes over here. But the whole thing to me about being smart is that there's a connected data stream heading back to some central intelligence area that helps to change the resources and it becomes some kind of dynamic city that works together. And so if Woven City is something a little bit more advanced like that, it's probably less of a automated vehicle value add than it is an actual demonstration of what a city can do if it connects all its data together for the services.
Well, that's interesting. That's a neat perspective, actually. And that actually reminds me more of a thing that was launched, I want to say back in 2010. I haven't heard anything about it lately, but the Masdar City project outside of Abu Dhabi. This was a bit early for AV testing, but you're right. To the point of just testing the city components itself, the idea there was to build a fully, a 100% green, all kind of clean energy, everything fully recycled, renewable, 100%, right? And that was the idea, to see what you could do in a 10 square kilometer, 1 square kilometer, I don't know. Right. That's a really good point, yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's really hard. All these OEMs are trying to figure out how to shift from selling products to eventually providing services. And that means they're not selling to a person. They're trying to create partnerships with cities and municipalities. And it's not like they're all going to, their competitors are going to be in the neighborhood too. So it's not like they can just share the data. But, you know, our cities and our local governments are just like our federal government. They don't build things. They put out a RFP for a contract to have somebody build their website, right? There's somebody builds some system, but it doesn't feed back into a more centralized area. It's patchwork consistently. So the hope I would have for things that they build from the ground up like this is that they have control in the environment. They have support from the local and larger government to do it right. And if they could demonstrate some really key long-term value out of doing it that way, it might start to pull people along. But
you know, that's a really good point. And I think it's one of the things that we need to see more of. You mentioned municipalities, you know, I mean, in general, and, you know, you look at cities like Boston, which actually have in the mayor's office an actual autonomous vehicles working group. And you're right, we're going to need to see a lot more of these in more cities to actually work with these companies collaboratively, because otherwise, you know, if they're not going to meet somewhere in the middle, then none of this is going to work.
Yeah. People have these hopes for lower traffic on the road because, you know, people aren't driving their personal vehicles and they're using these shared services. But if you've got, you know, 15 rideshare service companies with their vehicles parked outside of the city, and then at 5 a.m. they start sending them in, you have like, you're stuck in traffic with 20 empty cars around you because you decided to drive in that morning. And you're like, how does this make sense? So
we have carpool lanes already disincentivizing with penalties, right? So I would imagine that in the future, it's going to be occupancy-based, well, tolling, basically, right? Like a carpool lane. So an empty car is going to be effectively taxed really heavily in a full car, right? Because the idea is not so much, you don't want empty cars driving around, basically.
It's wild potential if all these companies are not working together and or sharing about demand and where they're going to be servicing. And
well, true.
I can feel like we have these great ideas, but when it comes down to it, these are going to be companies trying to pick up fares and make money. So it's going to be true. Really interesting. Maybe they'll self-select, you know, maybe Ford is focused on Miami and DC right now, right? Like they're first to market. Maybe they're just going to try to corner that area and not attempt to, I don't know, hit a different place like Texas or something.
Well, geez, what does that remind us of? I mean, that's what the airlines did, right? That's how they started. So a lot of overlap yet again.
Yeah. Learn from our past if we can.
Absolutely. Very cool. Well, anyway, this has been awesome. Obviously, it's been great to finally make this happen. Despite all the aborted attempts a month and a half or so ago, it's really great to have you here. I would certainly welcome you back to have another chat if you'd like some point down the road. But gosh, that's been great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mark. This is great. Look forward to the next one.
Awesome. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
All right, well, that is a wrap for today, and indeed this week. Please don't forget to follow me personally on all social media at Autonomous Hogue, and of course, if you're at an autonomous vehicle or mobility urban planning company and you'd like some expertise, don't forget to reach out to us over at Hogue & Co. That's at hogueandco.com, HOAGANDCO, and of course, you can follow us on all social media at, you guessed it, Hogue & Co. Thanks again very much indeed. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you back here next week on Tuesday. Bye-bye.